Good morning and welcome to Locus Focus. I'm Barbara Bernstein, your host for this weekly conversation about our place on the planet. And I'd like to welcome our new listeners in Seattle listening to KBFG LPFM 107.3. Donald Trump is targeting the Pacific Northwest for accelerated fossil fuel development. He brought the Jordan Cove liquid natural gas terminal in Coos Bay back from the dead, designating it as the highest priority site for LNG development on the West Coast. And now he's opening up the coastal waters of Oregon, Washington, and California to oil drilling. In doing so, he's trying to cross a thin green line of resistance that obviously he knows or cares little about. This morning, we talk again with Dan Sears, Columbia Riverkeeper Conservation Director, about how the thin green line is holding firm against all the onslaughts of fossil fuel development being thrown at us, and look at the victories and coming challenges facing us this year. Dan, welcome back to Locus Focus.
It's great to be here. Thank you.
Well, let's start with last Thursday as an example of the thin green line rallying itself. What happened?
Yeah, last Thursday, Oil Change International released a report about the Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector projects in southern Oregon, which would be the largest fracked gas project we've seen in some time. They would export liquefied fracked gas. We're really trying to transition from calling it natural gas to anything, but it is definitely fracked gas headed out. And so on Thursday, Oil Change released a report in cooperation with the folks at Rogue Climate and a group of landowners along the pipeline route that showed that this project would be by far Oregon's largest greenhouse gas polluter, both at the site of the terminal where they would liquefy the gas, and then looking more importantly at the life cycle of this fracked gas export, it found that it would emit anywhere from 36 to 52 million tons of carbon pollution into the atmosphere. This is, you know, an enormous number. It really dwarfs anything else going on in the state. And, you know, that report, I think, provided the basis for a lot of people to come to Salem and to rally. And so by my count, there were about 300, more than 300 people there.
There were enough that you and I didn't see each other.
That's right. exactly. On the steps of the Capitol in the pouring rain, people were there to call on Governor Kate Brown to step up and to do a little bit of what she's doing with the drilling issue and to stand up for Oregon and to reject this Trump fracked gas pipeline project.
And one of the things that struck me about that rally was the diversity of people there, both just different demographics, but also they came from all over the state.
There is really no more regionally diverse issue than fighting fracked gas. I mean, it's pretty remarkable. You know, the last time we held a big rally on the steps of the Capitol was in 2015, and Robert F. Kennedy Jr. was one of the keynote speakers. This group, I think, you know, you could look at and see is even being more mixed because there was a big contingent coming up from the Klamath, which was fantastic to see a couple young Klamath tribal leaders who spoke at the rally and spoke very powerfully about the importance of this project not going forward. And they've taken an official position against the Pacific Connector pipeline. It was really stirring to see such a swath of people. And then, you know, people who've been there since the beginning, former Secretary of State Bill Bradbury, who gave a fiery sermon at the end about how we're going to stop this project.
Don't we wish he was Secretary of State of Oregon now?
He's, you know, it took a lot of guts when he stood up and opposed LNG, and he called it out. He was ahead of his time, and he called out LNG as a big-time problem for our effort to deal with climate change. She said it was, you know, 180 degrees in the wrong direction for Oregon. And this is back in 2007, 2008. And so we're finally getting to the point where I think a lot of people are recognizing that the LNG proposal in Oregon is really being driven forward by the Trump administration and their agenda to increase fracking, to increase the movement of very polluting fossil fuels. And we're also seeing the resistance to that project grow and grow. So groups here locally meet monthly, actually a little bit more than monthly, with a group called Stop Frack Gas PDX. And we have, you know, all volunteer group, and we have a steering committee, and we'd love to have more people involved. Here in Portland, we're really trying to support however we can the fight in Southern Oregon. And the fight in Southern Oregon is really heated up. You know, people, the leadership that's coming from the Rogue Valley is remarkable. They're really identifying the pipeline as the linchpin for this project.
Well, it struck me that the leadership is much more clearly tribal people now than we noticed before. I think back in the beginnings of this project, and this project's been reported on KBOO for many, many years. In fact, I think for a while we're the only station in Oregon, probably right. reporting on it. And we mostly heard from white landowners back in those days. What has shifted so that the tribes have taken more focus? Is this coming from the tribes themselves, or is it also coming from white people like stepping aside a little bit and listening to the voices of tribal people who are going to be every bit as impacted as the white landowners?
I think it's the stepping aside is a big part of it. And that, you know, I give a lot of credit to the people in Southern Oregon who have created some space for this message to get out. And then the tribe has just taken a firm stand, and many tribal members, from my understanding, had participated in the Standing Rock issue and found that to be inspirational. And so, I mean,
we have a pipeline here at home. We have to fight.
They made a movie, which is very informational, short film. It's about 20 minutes long. I would encourage folks to find it on YouTube. If you Google Klamath Tribes and LNG pipeline, that'll pop up in the video. And they've taken, you know, they've asked for to deny the project. They've weighed in officially in opposition. I think the other dynamic here is that it's clear to everyone that this federal administration is going to, in all likelihood, approve this project. And so it is going to fall to us here in Oregon to persuade our state leaders to say no to this project. And so I think that's part of why we see people from all across the region becoming more vocal, realizing that we will not be saved by FERC this time around.
Well, let's back up a little bit, because one of the things that's so striking about this project is that I believe at least twice before it's been pronounced dead, thanks to FERC, which we should expect, Federal Energy
Regulatory Commission.
Right. And that obviously anybody who's been following the news in the last year knows why FERC has changed. But let's talk a little bit about why it seems so likely before Trump was elected that this pipeline wasn't going to be built, and therefore the LNG terminal wasn't going to be built.
Yeah, I mean, this is one of those very, very few projects that is so distinguished in its badness in being just a terrible idea that FERC actually denied it. So in 2016, the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission found that the project had unacceptable impacts on landowners, that it had no real market purpose, and they denied it. And this decision was both a surprise. We actually expected that we were going to have to challenge a FERC approval, but also a real indication that this project was just a failure. And it has been trying to gain approval since 2004. That's when I first became aware of Jordan Cove. First as an import LNG terminal, and then the market shifted, and they denied for months and months that they were ever going to consider exporting LNG.
Just as in Clatsop County.
Exactly. There. Yeah, and they said up and down, well, we'll never export LNG. We'll never propose that. That's a stupid idea. I quote, a stupid idea is what Bob Braddock, who was the project manager of Jordan Cove, said at the time. And about 3 months later, they proposed to flip to export. So the bait and switch has been on full display in Southern Oregon from the very beginning of this project, where initially they even said that they would use the existing Coos County pipeline. So we're in now, the way I see it is we've defeated this project twice. The people in Coos Bay, you know, Jody McCaffrey and Citizens Against LNG, they've been at this since 2004, you know, and all of the people who are getting involved now I really believe they're going to put this over the top and are going to stop this project in its tracks. I've never seen more resistance to the Pacific Connector and Jordan Cove project than I see right now across Oregon.
Well, I guess the other thing that seems really, that makes this project different from oil and coal projects, and I think the same could be said originally for the LNG proposals, and there were quite a few of them proposed for the Astoria area, all of which were defeated over the last 13 years or something.
Yes.
But there seems to be a lot of governmental support, both here and in Washington, for frack gas. I mean, Governor Jay Inslee, who is poised, we believe, to deny the Vancouver Energy proposal by Charles Savage in Vancouver to go through, has not spoken out strongly against the world's largest methanol refinery being proposed just 30 miles north of that in Klamath. And I know that John Kitzhaber was certainly a big fan of LNG. Kate Brown seems to be quiet about it. Why, with the exception of Bill Bradbury, who's unfortunately no longer in office, and I think there were two state reps who are opposed to LNG, why is there some kind of an acquiescence about frack gas being seen as a more benign form of as a bridge fuel, let's say, to the future of renewables. Why is it still seen that way, despite the kinds of information that, for instance, Oil Change International has been bringing up?
The natural gas industry, as they call themselves, has greenwashed this fossil fuel for decades, and I think that's what we're up against. They have contributed to the Democratic Party and Democratic candidates, you know, in the past years, and I think that they are far more entrenched in our region than even the coal industry was when we started fighting these big coal export proposals. So we have our work cut out for us in just combating the branding of natural gas as a clean burning fuel. Now, here in our region, we know that it's fracked gas. Most of it would come from fracking fields, and there's nothing clean about fracking. It poisons groundwater. It releases enormous amounts of methane into the atmosphere, and that gobbles up any advantage it would have had over coal and its greenhouse gas emissions. It has impacts on water, and so we really have to bring these issues in front of these key decision makers. You know, we're not giving up on trying to persuade FERC necessarily on denying this again. You know, we'll weigh in with FERC, but the really important decisions on all these projects for fracked gas are going to be at the state level. So Governor Brown, her agencies have very clear authority over the Jordan Cove LNG project. Governor Inslee initially supported this methanol refinery in Kalama and has since become a little less vocal about that support since that project was dealt a major legal blow, and it came to light that they were not accurately accounting for its greenhouse gas emissions. So we're in a place where actually we're going to be seeing major comment periods for all of these major fracked gas projects coming up in the next month or two.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Sears with Columbia Riverkeeper, and we're kind of doing an update on the effort to hold the Thin Green Line here in Oregon, and we'll be talking about all forms of fossil fuel that have been defeated, but we're going to be talking particularly today about fracked gas, which is the, I guess, the new frontier of the fossil fuel fight. And you're listening to us here on KBOO Community Radio and in Portland, and also on KBFG LPFM in Seattle. Let's talk a little bit about methanol and this Kalama refinery. We've been talking about it more on the show, and I'm doing a project that's focusing on this now, so I'm learning a lot myself. And I went up to Kalama for the first time to meet with people who have been fighting this for, I think it's 4 years now. So it's not as long as Jordan Cove or the Clatsop County fights against liquid fracked gas, but it's certainly a long time for these people. And one of the things that I learned when I was up there, unbeknownst to me, that for the last year they've also been fighting a proposed ammonia plant in Longview. So what's going on in Cowlitz County, and why is there so much pressure right now on that region, the Longview, Kelso, Kalama region, to become a center for exporting, manufacturing and exporting all kinds of fossil fuel based on fracked gas?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, what we see in this stretch from Vancouver to Port Westward, you know, that stretch of 30-some-odd miles of river has been a target since 2004, really, for major movement, for the movement of large volumes of fossil fuels. Fracked gas is the most recent arrival, but in some ways it was the first, you know, where they tried to put up, I think it was at 1.4 different LNG terminals in the lower Columbia River.
Now, I'm kind of curious, when they started, because actually Eric DePlace gave me absolution last week for having made our house all natural gas, and it was in 1993. Back in those days, it wasn't fracked.
That's true.
And it was seen as a whole lot cleaner than coal and oil. When did fracking become the predominant way for producing methane, basically?
Yeah, the shale gale, as they call it, came in 2007, 2008, 2009. That's really when we started seeing it ramp up.
So actually when these terminals were originally proposed back in 2004, yes. Sounds like that was when they started proposing them in Astoria and up on the Columbia, further up on the Columbia River and down at Jordan Cove. In those days, there was a shortage. I remember actually our decision to go all natural gas in 1993 got very expensive, like 10 years later, because natural gas was running out. So was that the rationale in those days? We need to import more natural gas from China?
That's right. The idea then was to import liquid natural gas from places like Qatar. Indonesia was a big exporter, Australia a big exporter, and Russia. and to bring that fuel in through Oregon and to really feed the West Coast natural gas grid with imported liquefied natural gas. Now, it became very clear that that was not going to happen after a couple years when LNG prices overseas were much, much higher than prices here in the United States. Despite that, these companies kept seeking permits as import terminals, including some that Jordan Cove still sits on. And now they seek, of course, to export this fracked natural gas. So that turn, depending on, you know, who you believe, the gas industry may have been very, very aware that they were going to be proposing for exporting LNG rather than importing it.
So you think that back in 2004, 2003, when these proposals first started, that the game plan was these are going to be export terminals, but we'll just go in into the sheep's clothing of export?
I don't know if there are some people who think that they were aware at that time. I'm personally not sure what they knew. I know that they were very aware that they were going to be flipping to export long before they admitted it in public. There were, you know, a couple farmers in Yamhill County who brought this up way back in 2007. They said they are plugging holes right now in the middle of the continent. This stuff is all for export. They have more gas than they know what to do with.
And what do you mean they're plugging holes?
They were aware of gas drilling going on in the middle of the United States where they didn't have, you know, outlets to markets that could soak it up. And they said, this is going to be exported LNG. And I didn't believe them at first. I believe them now.
I wonder how they knew about that.
I don't know if they had investments or what, but I will tip my hat to, you know, there were a couple of folks in Douglas County and Yamhill County who were far ahead of the curve on that particular perception that this was a big bait and switch. So where that leaves us in Cowlitz County is that they have these two really significant potential users of fracked gas. The methanol terminal would use over 300 million cubic feet of fracked gas a day. That's a huge amount. It's about, it's almost half what Oregon uses by comparison.
For the whole state.
For the whole state, for all purposes, for fracked gas.
How does it compare with what Washington state uses?
It's roughly a third for all uses, again, in the state of Washington. The anhydrous ammonia facility that's proposed by Pacific Coast Fertilizer, we know a little bit less about, but it seems it could use up to about 60 million cubic feet of gas a day. So big, not quite on the scale of the methanol proposal. But these are pretty close to each other. One is in Kalama, one is in Longview. They both have significant potential risks to the community. You know, people I think have recent memories of ammonia facilities having problems and
like blowing up.
Blowing up, yes. To be very blunt, they're blowy uppy is the term. It's a scientific term. It's a huge concern for people in Longview who I think are eager to see their community move in a direction that is not so reliant on single, huge, heavily polluting industries. You know, they've been kind of tormented by this coal export proposal, which is still filing lawsuits left and right, even though they've been denied by multiple state agencies now in the state of Washington. That's a project that's just never going to happen, the Millennium Coal Project. And in its wake, we see these two major fracked gas proposals. And I should mention, there's a second proposed methanol refinery in Oregon at Port Westward, at a site just downstream and across the river from Longview. The same place that was proposed for coal export, both Kinder Morgan and Amber Energy had sought to export coal from Port Westward. It's the site of the Global Partners ethanol/oil terminal. So it's a place in Columbia County that has been targeted for big, nasty fossil fuel projects. And there is, at least on paper, the same company is seeking to build an identical methanol refinery in Port Westward as Kalama, which would make, if you put these two together, it would absolutely necessitate building a major new gas pipeline somewhere through Washington to feed these projects. We simply don't have the amount of pipeline capacity we would need to export this huge amount of fracked gas as methanol to overseas markets. Initially, they talked about these projects, these methanol projects being used to manufacture plastics. They've since become more agnostic about the purpose, so it could be used for fuel overseas. And this was really one of the critical arguments that, this was the critical argument that our attorneys from Earth Justice won in court, and they persuaded a judge the Shorelines Hearing Board, actually a panel, that the environmental impact statement that had been written for the methanol terminal was inadequate. They hadn't looked at the actual impact of the whole project and what it would do in releasing greenhouse gas pollution. And so we're at a phase now where we're expecting potentially to have a new environmental impact statement and a new scoping period. So we'll get to weigh in once again about how this project would impact the climate.
Now, I just learned what scoping means last week. So explain, what is a scoping period?
Scoping is kind of the first stage of a National Environmental Policy Act process where people get to identify the range of different issues that should be assessed in an environmental impact statement. So it seems a little odd for something that's, you know, we've been dealing with for several years now, this methanol refinery, to be going through a new scoping. And the reason for that is that they wrote an environmental impact statement that was just blatantly inadequate, where they ignored major components of how the project would impact the environment. And so we're at sort of a reboot phase where they're going to have to go back and kind of write a new outline and then begin the work of assessing that. So that'll be happening through 2018. Where we'll have really important action in Cowlitz County on these fracked gas projects.
Now, some of the concerns that people raised is, among other things, that these companies are not local companies. In most cases, they're overseas companies. And I want to actually go back down to Jordan Cove for a moment, because at the rally last Thursday, there was a lot of throwing around of the name Pembina, which people in Portland might remember with a bit of distaste because they were trying to foist a liquid propane terminal in Portland just a few years ago. And they're a Canadian company. Now, I was wondering, when I heard that they're now the company that's behind Jordan Cove, is this new that Pembina is down there, or have they been the company all along?
This is new. Pembina bought Veresen, essentially. And so Veresen, when that project first began, Jordan Cove, there were three partners: Williams Pipeline Company, Pacific Gas and Electric out of San Francisco, which intended to use Oregon as a backdoor for getting its own gas, and then Veresen, which was then called Fort Chicago. So all the names have changed, all the players are different. And now what we're looking at is one single backer, really, for that huge project in Southern Oregon, and that's Pembina. And Pembina is... Pembina has lost in Oregon before when they seemed sure of victory. Initially they had Mayor Hale's support for that huge propane by rail terminal. Propane by rail is, as we ended up describing it, it was the part of oil trains that blows up. That's what they wanted to make, just whole trains of that and ship those through, you know, through Portland. So it was a bad idea. Building a fracked gas pipeline across some of the most rugged terrain, old growth forest, wild rivers, close to people's homes, through tribal lands, that's an even worse idea across Southern Oregon. So Pembina is going from one really bad idea to a worse one. And we look forward to the day when they're once again run out of town, run out of Oregon, with their, what I like to call their project. You have to use Canadian pronunciation.
Well, they make me think about Stephen Harper, who was the Prime Minister of Canada, basically Canada's own Dick Cheney on steroids, sort of a cross between Dick Cheney and Donald Trump, I think. And Pembina was just going, just ramming through all kinds of stuff in Canada and just spreading its tentacles with a lot of government backing. I'm wondering, now that the political winds in Canada have shifted a bit, if Pembina is like needing more American projects or if they're still going gangbusters in Canada as well.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real potential that the Jordan Cove terminal could be exporting primarily Canadian gas because of the way our system is plumbed. A lot of the gas could simply be passing through the United States to this, you know, to Coos Bay through these new pipeline, this new pipeline. And, you know, we essentially be a pass-through for shipping fracked Canadian gas overseas. And, it's a similar dynamic with the facility that's proposed in Coloma, Washington, where it's actually It's the Chinese Academy of Sciences.
And they call it Northwest.
Northwest Innovation Works is the name they've given the project, or the two projects on either side of the river. But they're essentially backed by the Chinese government, and they would be using the Lower Columbia River to move fracked gas in the form of methanol to China and to Chinese ports primarily.
Well, if you're just tuning in, we're talking this morning with Dan Sears, who's the Conservation Director for Columbia Riverkeeper. And we're talking today about the need to continue to hold the thin green line here in the Northwest as fossil fuel projects keep compounding with proposals to transform this area into a hub for the export of all kinds of fossil fuels. And you're listening here on KBOO Community Radio, here on Locus Focus, and on KBFG LPFM in Seattle. let's move to some of the victories, because we're going to be talking about frack gas, I think, in terms of really trying to stop it on many fronts for a long time to come. But maybe it's time to kind of gather ourselves up and remember some victories that happened. So let's talk about a couple things that have transpired just in the last couple weeks.
I mean, I think the first connection that comes to mind is with the Portland Fossil Fuel Ordinance. So there has been this movement to try to find concrete ways for communities to steer away from major new fossil fuel infrastructure. So out of that Pembina fight where they proposed the propane terminal came kind of a working coalition of people who really wanted to see the city stop new projects like that from even trying to apply and to steer Portland in as carbon-free a way as possible. So the city council under Mayor Hales in 2016 passed a landmark ordinance where they actually changed Portland's land use laws to prohibit and to restrict new major fossil fuel infrastructure. The Western States Petroleum Association, along with a couple others, including the Portland Business Alliance, challenged that ordinance and said it violated the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. They initially were successful at the Land Use Board of Appeals, but just in the last couple of weeks, the Oregon Court of Appeals issued a very clear-cut decision that said, no, Portland has the right to protect the health and safety of its residents and to do this through this type of land use ordinance. And so we're very excited to see the constitutionality of what Portland did, the sort of courageous stand they took in 2016, be upheld by the courts. And so the next step for that is actually there's a couple relatively more minor, at least by comparison to the Commerce Clause, local land use issues that have to be resolved in front of the city. So it's not quite in full effect yet, but we can see how the city can move forward, and we expect to have more action on that in 2018. So it's a huge victory, and I just want to say the attorneys from the Cragg Law Center did an incredible job in working with the attorneys from the city of Portland and defending that decision, defending that ordinance, and getting the Court of Appeals to overturn a very challenging LUBA decision.
Now, I read a quote of yours last week after this decision came down, where you were raising concern that there are still members of the business community that see this as an opportunity to get in and make the ordinance more friendly to them, basically.
Yeah, we saw that from the Portland Business Alliance. They sort of tipped their hand and said, you know, we're looking forward to talking with City Council about how to amend this ordinance. After a more than year-long scorched earth legal campaign, I really see no reason for why the Portland City Council would look to weaken this ordinance. And so we're going to be reaching out to our members, and I know our partners like Center for Sustainable Economy and Portland Audubon, 350, Physicians for Social Responsibility, this sort of ad hoc coalition that helped to make this happen. We will be reaching out to all of you who are listening to make sure that the Portland Business Alliance is unsuccessful in weakening this ordinance.
But maybe I should keep playing that quote from the guy from Kinder Morgan who really destroyed their position on the day that the city council basically agreed on the ordinance. Actually just describe what he did, because I think that and again sort of shows when they really start to play their hand.
Yeah, and the contrast was that there was a Lincoln High School student who spoke very passionately and eloquently about the need for the city to pass the strongest ordinance possible. And then immediately following her was a representative from Kinder Morgan who basically said, we need to be able to expand our terminals by 50% or more. Nothing you're doing here can help us, really. And so that kind of, all of a sudden we saw a light click on in the eyes of a couple commissioners who said, well, if making this a weak ordinance doesn't do you any good, we've got 300 some odd people packing this city hall, hanging from the rafters, telling us to make it as strong as possible. So we're going to do that. And I just give it a lot of credit to the young people who spoke that day, who I think really put the best foot forward for our coalition. And both by having, I think it's an example of how people from any walk of life, any age, can weigh in these public processes and can make a real difference. And I think it's a great example for what we need to have happen more with Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector.
Actually, there were quite a few young people. I saw a whole crowd of middle school students from Sunnyside who were at the rally at the Capitol last Thursday. And then there are a lot of young tribal representatives as well who are in leadership positions.
That's right.
So let's talk a little bit more about, there's another victory, which seems in some ways, well, the struggle was longer, let's say, to get there. And that has to do with the Tesoro project, the planned project to build the North America's largest oil by rail terminal in Vancouver, Washington.
Yes, we can see the end of this oil train from here, is I think how I would sum it up. So people have been watching this proposal since 2013, where Tesoro and Savage Companies partnered to propose a 360,000 barrel per day oil train terminal. So that's almost half the size of Keystone XL in oil trains. So up to 5 loaded mile-long trains a day coming down the Columbia River. When they first proposed it, you know, we were right in the wake of the Lac Mégantic disaster, which killed 49 people in Quebec. And despite that, they pressed forward. They gained a lease from the Port of Vancouver, and then they went about the task of trying to persuade the state of Washington to approve this huge bomb train terminal. And finally, as of December, we have a decision from the Energy Facility Site Evaluation Council in Washington, which unanimously recommended denial of the oil train terminal. I would just say, you know, it seems obvious now that an oil train terminal is an incredibly bad idea. And it seems obvious to us that this should never have been considered or certainly shouldn't be approved. That was not so clear in 2013. When this first came forward, it seemed to have support, you know, certainly had the support of the Port Commission, seemed to have more local support than it does now. But one oil train derailment after another, one community after another, and particularly the voices of, I think, neighborhood leaders, of tribal leaders along the Columbia River who said, look, many of our fishers make their living between the tracks and the river, this narrow wedge of land. There was a great story in the Oregonian by Molly Harbarger who really spelled out the level of risk for people living along the Columbia River. And the longshoremen, you know, they were one of the first to speak up about this. And I think they're taking a position on this. Local 4 in Vancouver, Cager Claybaugh and Jared Smith, who were the two presidents of the Longshore Union during this period, they spoke up and said, you know, we know that there could be some jobs in this, but the risk is not worth the reward. And so what we finally see is the Energy Council in Washington saying, in 450 pages of detailed findings, the reasons why a bomb train terminal in Vancouver is a bad idea. Where that leaves us is Governor Inslee has until we think about mid-February to make this decision. We certainly hope that he makes the right one. We see no reason for him to disagree with or step outside of what FSEC has recommended. Their process was incredibly thorough. They went through a month-long evidentiary trial and thoroughly vetted the project. And for people who might remember the summer of 2016, that was right in the wake of the Mosher oil train derailment. They made novel arguments like oil spills create jobs.
Tesoro Savage
had experts arguing that, among other things, oil spills create jobs, and oil spills can be good for fish and wildlife because they close fishing and hunting, and so more fish and wildlife would survive than were killed. I don't know if I'm properly getting the sarcasm across in the radio, but Natasha Geiling from Think Progress wrote a great article about this in 2016, and it was the kind of just irresponsible, useless argument that we saw the oil company make throughout this project. And so most recently, I think what many people were really thrilled to see was the Port of Vancouver Commission. Finally, after years and years and years, a new commission taking office, 3 members, Jerry Oliver, who has been there for a long time, Eric LeBrand, who was elected in 2015 on a no oil platform, and Don Orange, who was elected in 2015, also on a platform opposing the oil terminal.
John Orange just elected last month.
Don Orange, elected in November by 30 points. So Tesoro and Savage put in over $700,000 into his opponent's campaign. I mean, we're talking Port of Vancouver Commission. This is normally a sleepy little race. Don ran, I think, a heroic campaign, and he galvanized people all over Clark County who had been opposed to this project, and they all turned out and they all voted, and it sent a super clear message about the fate of this project.
So they voted to terminate the lease.
So on last Tuesday, the Port Commission essentially gave notice to Tesoro Savage that the lease would expire on March 31st, 2018. There would be no further extension of the lease, which is a very clear-cut authority they had within the lease. So the previous commission had actually negotiated for this rolling three-month review window, and the next available, you know, three-month review date is the end of March. And so rather than, you know, trying to terminate the lease immediately, they took kind of the very reasonable step of saying, well, we're just going to let this thing expire on its own. The only way that wouldn't happen is if somehow Tesoro Savage were to obtain all of their necessary permits and authorizations before March 31st, 2018. It's not likely that that is going to happen.
I think not possible, actually.
Very, very difficult. It's hard to imagine how that would happen. I mean, they're now in an appeal. Well, they've chosen not to appeal the FSEC recommendation, meaning Governor Inslee is now on the clock to make his decision. So it seems very unlikely that they would be able to get the approvals they need.
And then one more proposal on the ropes. You mentioned briefly before the Millennium coal terminal. So what's happening with that?
You know, it's interesting timing. Millennium filed a federal lawsuit alleging Commerce Clause violations by the state of Washington. So the state of Washington had denied the Millennium coal project in multiple ways. First, they denied them the use of state lands. The reason why I think this is also interesting is this decision-making authority parallels what Oregon enjoys for the Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector project. So they didn't allow the use of state lands for the coal export project in a Millennium suit over that. They didn't allow Clean Water Act certification under Section 401 of the Clean Water Act. They didn't. They couldn't find that the project would comply with the state's water quality laws, and they denied the project for that reason. So these are very significant rejections. And the coal company, Millennium, the same company that was trying to barge coal down the Columbia River to the port westward, they are seeking a federal court. They're hoping a federal court will find that this violated the Commerce Clause of the Constitution. And so they made that argument, or at least filed a motion, and you know, the day before we got the very strong Oregon Court of Appeals decision on the Commerce Clause, we have, you know, in our nation, we have these regulatory processes, and a lot of that authority is delegated to states. They're really railing against a system that is honestly often works in the favor of developers, which is has been the frustration of many in the environmental movement. And in this case, you know, we see the most outrageous, most polluting projects finally receive denials, and the fossil fuel industry is pretending as if they've been horribly wronged. You know, this is a company that began its effort in Longview by lying through their teeth and telling everyone they wanted to build a 5 million ton per year coal export facility, when in fact they wanted to build something between 40 and 60 million tons. And this is where great organizing meets great legal work. People built a lot of community pressure against this project, and the attorneys who were challenging that initial proposal discovered that they wanted to build something that was an order of magnitude higher in terms of its throughput of coal. And those two things converged to really, you know, we started seeing hundreds and even thousands of people turning up in Longview to hearings about this project, many of whom were from Calhous County and most of whom were strongly opposed to the project. And so that's the short story, but what we are seeing now from the fossil fuel industry is sort of an effort to get federal decisions or a federal override over these places where the states have actually stood their ground. And so what we're going to need from Oregon and Washington is a lot of backbone from our governors to hold the line.
Well, the lawsuit that Millennium filed against the state of Washington kind of reminds me of the libel suit that Trump's lawyer was threatening to file against the new book Fire and Fury by Michael Walsh. And I just wonder, you know, is it bluster? Or I mean, because people that lawsuit's been laughed out of before it even gets to court. Do you think that the Millennium lawsuits are kind of similar kind of bluster?
I think they're an attempt to vilify the state leaders who have taken their responsibility of protecting the environment and protecting the climate seriously. They're an effort to kind of drag these agencies through difficult legal processes and to try to find ways to embarrass the agencies. I think in the end, we think it's clear that both Oregon and Washington have the authority they need to deny projects like these. We have environmental laws for that often don't work to protect our water and air, that often permit far too high levels of pollution. But in these really outrageous instances, we've seen the states actually deny the projects. You know, Oregon denied an LNG terminal once. It was called Bradwood LNG on the Columbia River because it was going to have an enormous negative impact on salmon. So we think it's clearly within the authority of the state of Washington to deny what would now be the largest coal export terminal proposed in North America, 44 million tons of coal, 8 loaded coal trains a day. This is an idea that is so wrong for Washington, so wrong for the climate, that, you know, we think it's absolutely clear that Washington has the authority to say no to this.
Well, we're talking this morning with Dan Sears, who's a conservation director for Columbia Riverkeeper here on KWU Community Radio and also on KBFG, LPFM in Seattle. Well, in the last part of the show, I want to move away from fossil fuel into another area. It's another source of energy that's also been called a bridge fuel to the future, and that's nuclear power. But specifically an area along the Columbia River that doesn't really, well, there's one nuclear power plant there, but it's really much more renowned for its bombs. So let's talk a little bit about Hanford, which has been a problem for 75 years and doesn't seem to be going away very quickly. And this is another purview of Columbia Riverkeeper, because one of the places that you watch the river is all on the Hanford Reach.
Yeah, and this area kind of came into the spotlight thanks to the Trump administration again this year for a couple of reasons. First, the Hanford Reach is a national monument. It was on the list of ones to be reviewed. It's currently not on the table for being reduced in size, thanks to efforts from grassroots pressure all over the state.
Well, let's just back up a little time. The Hanford Reach, I mean, some people know about the Hanford Reach, but it's a kind of a strange anomaly. I mean, why is it a national monument, and what exactly is it?
You know, it's several hundred thousand acres that wrap around, a 40-mile stretch of the Columbia River that flows through this nuclear site that was used to make plutonium for nuclear weapons throughout the Cold War, beginning with the Manhattan Project in World War II. Because it was off limits, because it was a nuclear site, it remained undammed, relatively untouched, if you ignore the large plutonium reactors along one shoreline. And so it's a really interesting place where you see a lot of wildlife. It's the best mainstem spawning habitat for Chinook salmon and the entire mainstem of the Columbia River, the entire system. So many of the Chinook salmon we see moving through our part of the Columbia are headed for Hanford in the Hanford Reach. It's an interesting place because it's really a collision of incredible arid beauty and a free-flowing Columbia River with the most contaminated place in North America, where decades of plutonium production for nuclear weapons led to enormous levels of contamination in soil, dozens of square miles of groundwater contaminated above drinking water standards, the shoreline of the Columbia River being sort of leached into with this contaminated groundwater and being radioactive and chemically polluted. And it's a place where we now spend roughly $2 billion a year to try to protect the Columbia River, to keep the waste from becoming more of a problem, and to find a long-term solution to this very big mess that was made.
Well, when I first started doing projects about Hanford back in the early 80s, there was fear that the radiation was going to get into the groundwater. I think it has at this point.
It's for sure in the groundwater. Yeah, there's a huge plume of tritium that reaches the Columbia River. There's a large plume of iodine-129 that is approaching the Columbia River. There are places where strontium, like near the N reactor, which was one of the really behemoth big producers of plutonium for many years. Strontium 90 is kind of leaching out in an area where there's a high level of groundwater flow into the Columbia River. So there's no question that there's contamination reaching the Columbia. Now, the Columbia River in this place is big. It's flowing. It's, a little bit cooler than other parts of the Columbia at times. And it dilutes it, despite that you can pick up contamination from Hanford downstream, not at levels exceeding drinking water standards, at least according to the Washington Department of Health and Department of Energy, but it is there. And there's absolutely no question that if you go and you dropped a well into certain areas of Hanford, the water that you would pull up would be contaminated enough to pose a risk.
Well, I also recall when I've been on the reach, there's these little metal markers in the ground in places, which are basically radioactive monitoring watches. And I think there are these little hot spots, even even in areas where I've hung out and where, like, the Columbia River Intertribal Fish Commission goes, they do these salmon catches every year to basically track the salmon and to mark some of the salmon. It seems like even in this place that's considered relatively pristine and certainly promoted by the Department of Energy as this great pristine place in the Columbia River, there's some serious contamination.
There is. And, you know, what people have heard about most recently in the news have been issues with worker exposure, where they're trying to demolish very contaminated facilities like the plutonium finishing plant. And that poses really significant challenges for worker safety and the environment. They began pulling apart one of these buildings, and it led to exposures to workers where they're ingesting and inhaling plutonium, and then some of the contamination reaching people's vehicles, some of which were driven off site. These are issues that groups like Hanford Challenge have done a really great job in trying to elevate the concerns of workers who really are doing a heroic job out there of trying to protect the environment and the rest of the state from this very nasty pollution.
Well, I mean, there's this kind of this whole array of contamination there. There's the tank farms, and there's the original tank farms from the 40s and early 50s, which were single shell tank farms, which started leaking really badly, I think, in the early 70s. And then there's the double shelled tank farms that they were supposed to be transferring these radioactive in a kind of sludgy, almost liquidy waste from the single shell to the double shell. And I think they did finish that at some point, maybe about 15 years ago. And there's been issues there. And then the double shell tanks are also leaking. And then there's that infamous tunnel that collapsed. So talk about, like, there's this wide array of contaminants that people are dealing with there.
Yeah, there's a wide array of contaminants.
And not to mention those trenches, the open, unlined trenches where they were dumping low-level waste for about 40 years.
Yeah, we had an event in Hood River called the Sense of Place Lecture this past week, and one of the people who spoke was Dirk Dunning, who's recently retired from the Oregon Department of Energy, and he sort of did a deep dive into these different areas that people have heard about in the news, the Purex Tunnel, where, you know, half the plutonium in the United States was produced in this building, and there's a tunnel next to it where they put very radioactive equipment, and he kind of explained in great detail how it was built, why the radiation levels may have led to its collapse, and how filling it with cement is really an only interim solution. It's going to have to be excavated and removed in all likelihood if it turns out to be as radioactive as everyone expects it is. Other places like the plutonium finishing plant, where he pointed out these are very contaminated facilities that had lots of plutonium inside, which is, you know, can be dispersed in the environment very quickly if it's not handled very carefully. And then the tanks, which, the state of Washington, many people throughout the region, including the Hanford Advisory Board, have urged the Department of Energy to invest in new tanks because the ones they have are leaking and don't provide adequate space for handling this very dangerous waste. And it's not just the radioactive material, some of which is extremely long-lived. The half-life of plutonium is 24,000 years. The White Bluffs at Hanford were carved out 14,000 years ago by Missoula floods. So it's, you know, we've created a problem that is longer-lived than the landscape in which it exists. And so in 2018, what we expect to have happen is for the Department of Energy to go into negotiations with the state of Washington and the US EPA about the timeline and the goals for Hanford cleanup. So there'll be potentially very important decisions made in 2018 about how much of that tank waste we end up just filling with cement and leaving behind, how much groundwater cleanup we invest in for coming years. These really important decisions, we've seen not a whole lot of activity in the last couple of years on Hanford, but it seems like there's going to be an uptick. And so we're going to be reaching out to people to really maintain their their vigilance on Hanford. And I should also mention that Oregon Physicians for Social Responsibility has been very active in this area, this issue, and they are really the ones focused on the Columbia Generating Station, which is the sole remaining nuclear-fired power plant in Oregon, Washington.
Whoops one, wasn't it?
I think it's actually whoops two.
Two, right, yeah,
yeah.
Right.
And so, you know, it sits right along the Columbia River. Its design is quite similar to the Fukushima reactors, and it has a lot of fuel there on site. And so it's an area that we're very concerned about. And, you know, PSR is making the case that there are more affordable and cleaner ways to make electrons move in our grid, particularly in the Northwest, than nuclear fission.
Well, I think we'll have another discussion about Hanford in a later day, because it's something certainly we need to be talking about a lot. Talking about a ticking bomb just up the Columbia River. We just got a couple more minutes left, and the one thing we haven't covered that we talked about covering before we started the show was the coal methane fracking that's going on in Coos County. So let's, in just a moment, sort of cover that and how that connects to all the other fossil fuel projects that you're trying to stop.
We don't know that much about it yet. We know that there's a company that used to be called Methane Energy Corp. They've been bought up by another company, and their proposal is there are kind of low-grade coal reserves in Coos County. If you pull the water out of those coal beds, it produces methane. And that methane is something they hope to gather and pipe into system. We don't know how it would interconnect exactly, but it, you know, potentially could be a source of methane for the Jordan Cove LNG project. The wastewater produced from coal bed methane can be very high in chemicals that are toxic. And so people are going to be urging Department of Environmental Quality, DEQ in Oregon, not to rubber stamp approvals for this project. So it's on county land in Coos County. It's not too far from Bandon, not too far from, it's south of North Bend, I think. So this is a place where, you know, we have a little bit of fracked gas production here in Oregon. The other place is up along the Columbia, well, sort of on the Coast Range by Mist. There are a couple wells up there. But this is a proposal that I think is really alarming because it's moved quietly and seemed to go. This came up in, I think it was 2008, and nothing has really happened there since then. And so the company behind it is, at least they've indicated they want to start producing gas again this year. And that could lead to the production of very polluted wastewater. And this is an issue we see throughout fracking all across the United States. You know, coal bed methane is a little bit different than fracking, but it has one big thing in common, which is the produced water that comes out of it can be very high in chemicals that are harmful to the environment, to human health, certainly to aquatic life. And so any proposal to discharge that wastewater into Coos Bay would be another injury to the many injuries that have been proposed alongside the Jordan Cove and Pacific Connector pipeline projects.
And this is another project we'll follow closely. Maybe we can talk about it again in a few months.
Yeah, and I think the folks in Coos Bay, like Jody and Katie from Citizens Against LNG, they're keeping their eye on this.
Well, I'll talk to them too.
Yes.
Well, Dan, it's great to talk with you, and I think we'll be talking again really soon. So
thank you, Barbara. Yeah, thanks for having me.
We've been talking this morning with Dan Sears, Columbia Riverkeeper Conservation Director, and you've been listening to Locus Focus here on KBOO Community Radio and KBFG LPFM in Seattle. If you're just tuning in and you'd like to hear what you missed, or you want your friends or family to hear the show, you can listen to it online or download the audio later this afternoon on our website, kboo.fm/locus-focus. Next week, we'll talk with Oregon State Representative Karen Power and Meredith Connolly with Climate Solutions about Oregon's Clean Energy Jobs Bill. And maybe we'll throw a question in about frack gas while we're there. My engineer is Patsy Kohlberg. I'm Barbara Bernstein. We're going to go out with some music by Anna Fritz. Thanks for listening. Stay tuned, because we're going to be covering Martin Luther King Day celebration for the rest of the day here in KBOO, and have a happy Martin Luther King Day, and a productive and serviceable one, too.
Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground, turn the ships around. Coal, oil, gas, none of these shall pass. Leave it in the ground and turn the ships around. Keep it going. Cascadia is a place of great power. We stand at the mouth of the river, rooted to the land and its people. We turn the ships around.